приказываю министру обороны с завтрашнего
министру
дня...
Министру обороны Сергею Шойгу начать вывод основных сил России из
14 марта Владимир Путин заявил о выводе...
Решение о выводе основной части российских сил из
Сегодня
Сирии...
Сегодня Россия начала вывод своих войск из Сирии.
Перед Министерством обороны и вооруженными силами в целом выполнены.
Six months ago, Russia was isolated internationally, bogged down in a quagmire in Ukraine and reeling from Western sanctions. And, oh, by the way, Moscow is about to lose its last ally in the Middle East. Now, after a 167-day bombing campaign, Bashar al-Assad is safe, and Vladimir Putin has a seat at the big table as co-sponsor of a ceasefire in the Syrian civil war. Putin's Syria gambit was always about more than Syria. It was about more than breaking Moscow's international isolation. It was about establishing a new paradigm for global politics based on balance and power and spheres of influence. It was about reviving a bipolar order reminiscent of the Cold War. Putin appears to have the upper hand in the tactical battle for Damascus, but can he ride that to a new Yalta? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, guys.
And also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Welcome back, Vladimir.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be with you back.
Good to have you as always. Well, in a gloating commentary in the official government newspaper, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, foreign affairs analyst Fyodor Lukyanov all but declared the post-Cold War order dead. And I want to quote from him. 25 years of trying to build a new world order have vanished into thin air, Lukyanov wrote. Once again, just like in the previous era, the real bosses remain Moscow and Washington, with no one else having the power or capacity to make important decisions and start to implement them. Vladimir, you wrote in Sloan.ru this week and in an excellent piece that, and I'm quoting you now, the Kremlin would like to make Syria a template not only for bilateral relations with the United States, but also to develop new rules of the game in a broader sense. But in the end, you conclude that we haven't quite arrived at a new Yalta yet. I tend to agree with you. How close are we? Is Lukyanov getting ahead of himself? Is Putin anywhere near getting to his goal of reviving the post-war Cold War security architecture?
Well, I think Lukyanov fairly accurately describes the objective that the Kremlin wants to achieve, and that is indeed the rewriting of the post-Cold War world order. But I think we need some reality check here, and I don't think we have reached that point yet. I think what could be argued is that we have reached some semblance of the good old Cold War bipolarity, but only with regard to one, fairly important region, the Middle East. And I think that has to do both with Russia's willingness and decisiveness in using force and the U.S. Hesitation and lack of strategy in Syria that opened up opportunities for Moscow to go in for. So Moscow has become a player. But I would say not a global player, but an important regional player in the Middle East, filling the vacuum created by the U.S. What Moscow will do with that new role in the Middle East remains unclear. Is it going to become a provider of Middle Eastern security, replacing the United States, as probably President Obama would not mind to? And what would it? What kind of benefits would it get for playing that role?
And what kind of costs would that incur?
And what kind of costs that would incur? Correct. Given the fact that the greatest beneficiary of security in the Middle East is now not the United States but China. Most of the Middle Eastern oil flows to China, and China is in no great hurry to play a security role in the Middle East. But for the larger objective, to achieve what Lukyanov describes and what I describe in my piece a stabilizing bipolarity without the ideological confrontation. Bipolarity between Russia and the United States as co-sponsors of the New World Order. I think for that to happen, we need to rewrite the rules of the game in Europe. And that's the larger goal, the more ambitious goal, which Putin clearly aims at, but we're not there yet. We have not achieved that objective. And a lot will depend how he plays out, how, you know, his Syria, fairly impressive, but still limited in terms of practical utility, success will play out with regard to other regions, particularly Europe.
And particularly Ukraine, as you...
Well,
as
sure, you... Europe is all about, Russia's... granting Russia a sphere of influence in the former Soviet space and to a certain extent in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So Ukraine is a pivotal point.
Now, Mark, you wrote about this topic as well this week in a commentary for Reuters in which you argue that Putin's goals were more modest, protecting an ally, establishing Russia as a player in the Middle East, and ending Russia's isolation. Do you think Moscow had a broader strategic goal here as well, like revising the post-Cold War order?
I think we have to be cautious because, in a way, there's what was the intent when the Russians first went into Syria, and then what they might be interpreting now from what actually has been a surprisingly and unexpectedly effective intervention. I mean, obviously, we have to treat what Lukyanov says with considerable caution, because to be perfectly honest, he would have to have ponytails and pom-poms to be any more of a cheerleader. But even so, I mean, I think he accurately channeled what might be a sort of a desire rather than an intent of the Kremlin. Of course, if the geopolitical fairy ever offered them a wish and said, would you like there to be a new Yalta, they would say yes. But I don't get the sense that they're really thinking that that is actually truly viable. And exactly, Syria is a small and still unsettled issue. It's not something that is going to lead to a complete rewriting, especially of the European decision. So I think it's more that, yes, they would love a new Yalta. In practice, though, I think this is part of their campaign to rewrite the architecture in a much more limited way. They don't necessarily want to be able to tell everyone else what to do, but they're back to this whole business of wanting exclusions. They want to ensure that they are emancipated from the post-Cold War sort of structures. I think that's actually more likely to be their long-term vision because it's a much more feasible one.
But if they're emancipated from the post-Cold War structures, that gives them a free hand in the post-Soviet space, which would in and of itself overturn the post-Cold War structures, no?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's a question of, I mean, firstly, the sort of post-Cold War structures obviously is a much more of a global phenomenon. It doesn't necessarily sort of imply the rest. But I think it's more, again, I think that it's this issue of the positive versus the negative. A new Yalta implies more than just simply, Yalta was not purely about spheres of influence. That was obviously very much at the heart of it. But it was also about, as it were, shall I say, a set of rules for the game. Yes, as far as they're concerned, they deserve a sphere of influence. And in practice, they largely have one. But I think, again, I don't think they're necessarily wanting to go beyond that. They basically, you know, what they really want to do is to declare independence from the world. That's really their aim. They just want to do their own thing and interconnect as is kind of mutually, pragmatically useful. But basically, they're just saying, look, everywhere outside of our immediate sphere of influence, we don't really care what happens. But likewise, we don't want the world to care what happens within our sphere of influence.
And that means that their neighbors will have limited sovereignty. And that would
Absolutely.
Mean that the rules of the game that have come into place since the end of the Cold War would be torn up.
Well, again,
I don't see a big difference between their being...
Let's not pretend that the rules of the game apply. I mean, look, sovereignty is always negotiable. Ask the Libyans. I mean, look, you know, we shouldn't pretend that there is something absolute and so crystallinely pure about the post-Cold War era that any shifts necessarily lead to a complete collapse of the whole. We're dealing with a best that we can manage system of global relations. I mean, you know, the same way as North Korea can get away with a certain amount because no one wants to tackle what actually doing more sort of active measures against North Korea would involve. I mean, this is just the the way it is. So I think it's what Russia is trying to do is, as it were, push the bounds of that pragmatic accommodation. I don't think it would completely destroy the world order. It is actually trying to make explicit what is largely implicit, which is actually that spheres of influence exist.
I would agree with this, that the goal, the objectives are actually modest in terms of regional reach. And I doubt that the Russians really want to rewrite the rules of the game in Asia, for that matter. But I think the whole point about Moscow striving to emancipate itself from the post-Cold War order is basically about Russia wishing to have the same kind of license to violate the world order as does the United States. That's the whole point about Russia being treated as an equal. Being treated as an equal in Moscow essentially is viewed as having the same kind of freedom of action as the United States does. And the reason we've started talking about bipolarity as a stabilizing factor is that both for Putin and for his circle, it's very important to be viewed as dealing on an equal footing with the United States, with the U.S. as a peer competitor. And it's a very important factor in terms of being perceived as a strong power, being perceived domestically as a strong authority, being able to deal with the United States on an equal footing. So it's both psychological and geopolitical. But again, it doesn't have a global reach in terms of dictating Russia's terms to the rest of the world. Mm. That's not the objective.
Mark, you indicated you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I wanted to very much agree with what Vladimir said with one kind of footnote or whatever. It's what Russia wants is to be equal to the United States as Russia sees the United States.
Very good point.
Right.
Very good point.
That's correct. That's very correct.
America looks from, the sort of the tower of the Kremlin. They genuinely believe, ludicrously enough, that Maidan was a CIA plot. I mean, I'm amazed. I keep thinking that someday I'm going to get to someone who will, with a twinkle in his eye, say, of course, we never believe that. But I honestly think they do. They have this sense. That the
no,
CIA
I get the same sense.
And actually, I mean, I would say, bless them, the CIA wish they could destabilize.
I wish they were that good.
Well, I would still be cautious. I mean, I would still take issue that they really, all of them sincerely believe that is the case.
Not all of them.
Some of them, say this with a grain of salt, with a pinch of salt.
That's hard to hear.
Lavrov doesn't. Lavrov knows better, and a lot of people around him know better. So
yeah, but people who actually make the decisions, which obviously immediately excludes Lavrov. But also, I mean, it says factor of sphere of influence. Again, I mean, although clearly there are lots of people with a much, much more nuanced and sensible perspective, there is at least a certain rump perspective amongst the decision makers that essentially Western Europe is part of the American sphere of influence. But yes, they want to try and play Germany against America and see if Brexit can sort of create some sort of divisions or whatever. But the general sense is still that somehow, South America and Europe and parts of Asia are part of an American sphere of influence, rather than thinking that it's the natural ties of culture, language, mutual beneficial economic and security advantage, et cetera, they see it as not a sort of a natural gravitation towards America, but as something that America has somehow maneuvered and imposed. So I think this is it. It's because they have this thoroughly distorted perspective of America's role that that's when they're sort of saying, well, what about us?
Yeah, no, I'd like to add to that, Mark, because I think that's a really good point. I mean, if you look at the Western system, it's based on consensus. And the United States doesn't have the total free hand that Moscow seems to think it has, with the exception of Iraq, with the notable exception of Iraq. Whenever the U.S. has acted in the world, it's been with, if not the consensus, the consensus of the U.N. Security Council, at the very least with the consensus of its NATO allies. And this is not a United States dictating terms to its allies, who Moscow tends to view as proxies. I mean, to tell that to the French, for God's sakes. I mean, a perfect example of this, bringing it back to Syria, is when Obama made the decision not to enforce the red line in Syria. A lot of that was because the support of the British wasn't there. When the British Parliament denied David Cameron the right to use force in Syria, that was played a big role in Obama's decision. So Moscow, but Moscow's system, the system Russia envisions, is not based on consensus. It's based on great powers dictating to their subordinates, and that's just not how the world works anymore.
I think we can fairly safely say that both Russia and the United States views or disagree fundamentally on what the rules of the game should be in the new world order and how they should be applied to different countries. There is no meeting of minds.
It's almost like we're talking past each other on this. One thing I wanted to get, if we could separate this out, because I think we are, Vladimir, as you pointed out early, really talking about Europe. What Moscow really cares about is the European security architecture, more than the post-Cold War world order, so to speak.
Correct.
How fragile or durable is the post-Cold War security architecture, what people like me like to call the rules-based order of Europe in since the end of the Cold War? How fragile or durable is that right now?
Well, I think it's fairly durable, given that it's underpinned by two fairly powerful institutions, the European Union and NATO, if we're talking about Europe. But in the long run, it would all depend on the domestic politics of certain European states, how those involve, and to a certain degree on the domestic politics of the United States.
Yes,
I think if the threats that are currently emerging in Europe and in the United States on the domestic scene do not really fully materialize in the next couple of years, maybe 5 years down the road, then we could say that the system would survive and would probably emerge stronger. But if some of those risks come to pass, Brexit, for that matter, be a change of government in Germany, change of government in France, That would lead to the weakening of at least one of those fundamental institutions that underpin that order. Mm-hmm. Then we would probably be able to say that all bets are off.
No,
that, of course, presumes that Russia stays where it is and it is not declining.
Yes, and we don't know what's going to happen domestically in Russia either.
Yes, correct.
No, I would tend to agree with you, Vladimir, and I would like go back to my favorite role on this podcast is to play the optimist. And I'm not playing here because I truly believe this. I think the West is passing through one of its moments, like we passed through in the 1970s, these periods of instability and turmoil and turbulence and self-doubt and retrenchment. I think this is just a moment. We went through, I saw this in my lifetime in the 70s, and the U.S. and the West as a whole emerged from it stronger. I don't expect the threats to materialize in the United States, to be quite frank. And with regards to Europe, I'm actually also pretty optimistic. I saw an interesting post, I don't know if you saw it today, Vladimir, as well, by Ulrich Speck, who is one of the sharper observers of the European Union. And he's saying just basically all these institutions we set up in easier times are being tested in harder times now. And if we can get through this, we're going to come out stronger. I think that was very well said, and I think it was pretty much on the mark. And for this reason, I do think the post-Cold War, the post-Cold War European security architecture is much more durable than it appears to be right now. Mark, any thoughts from you on this?
Yeah, I mean, my view is essentially that I agree that this is actually pretty durable. In that respect, almost perversely, the fact that there is such discussion and breastbeating about the challenges to the Western security architecture is a good sign. It's actually if we sleepwalked into a position in which there were serious challenges, then I think then things would really become problematic. And to that extent, we should all get together and thank that nice Mr. Putin for actually, in some ways, also providing a reminder for what NATO in particular is all about and why it's actually valuable. The interesting thing is precisely this issue about the nature of the challenges. The short-term challenge, I find it hard to take too seriously. It doesn't mean to say it's not important and so forth, but I don't think it poses any kind of existential threat to either any NATO member states or the institutions as a whole. And the long-term challenges that are much more about whether America increasingly sort of starts looking to its West, a genuine Pacific sort of intent, whether or not Europe can actually adapt to that, and therefore in some ways whether you get some kind of attenuation within the security architecture. These are way down the line.
Yeah.
And I cannot see the Russian challenge lasting more than a few years, quite frankly, because Russia just, A, cannot make this sort of effort continue. And secondly, it's all really dependent upon Putin and a very small handful of people. I don't get the sense that the Russian elite as a whole wants confrontation. They want a good, quiet life.
Right. Vladimir, would you agree with that? And also, go ahead.
Yes, I would agree that Russia would not probably have the resources to keep challenging the European security order for more than maybe 5 to 6 years. And I think a very interesting question right now would be, if Moscow cannot achieve the strategic objective of completely rewriting the rules of the game in Europe, what kind of a result would it be willing to settle for?
Hmm.
What could be the compromise that Moscow would be willing to declare a victory and essentially go home and revert back to the business as usual model?
Well, what do you?
It's not clear to me what this compromise is.
No, because I mean, you seem to have a good your finger on the pulse of things there in Moscow, and I'd be curious to think what is this compromise? Because I want to quote from your piece again, Vladimir, because I think this is one of the key points you make, where you say if Moscow's dream of a new bipolarity with Washington were to gain any traction, the Kremlin would have to jettison its zero sum approach and start showing some buy-in in a shared agenda, jointly developing solutions as opposed to gaining leverage by making itself first part of the problem. Do you think it's in this regime's DNA to do that?
Well, that's a very good question. I would probably fail to answer it in any persuasive way because I don't really know. But frankly, the times when Russia or the late Soviet Union were actually sharing in the constructive and positive agenda with the West were the late 80s and early 90s, up to the war in Yugoslavia. And that was based on in a significant way, was motivated by domestic political factors in Moscow that forced the Russian leadership to reconsider some of its long-held ideas about what Russian foreign policy should be.
It also had to do with a new generation coming to power. I mean, the Gorbachev generation. It's funny to think of that as the young generation, but I do remember when it was the young generation coming up and replacing the class of 38, so to speak, the Brezhnev generation. And this generation had a different outlook on things. But now we're not looking at any generational change coming anytime soon. And you have to wonder what it's going to, if it's possible for the domestic political shift to make that shift to a positive agenda with the West take place. Do you see any hope for that on the horizon in Moscow right now?
It's difficult to speak in such generalities. Mm. I mean, people's attitudes to things like this change, and sometimes quite rapidly.
Mm.
We're talking about if there is a significant change of leadership and directive from the leadership on how to view the world, a lot of lower-ranking people would quickly change their position in a matter of hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a generational thing or, broadly based and broadly held beliefs. It's more a question of adapting yourself to what the policy guideline is.
Mm.
And the Russian bureaucracy is very adaptive to policy guidelines coming from the top. I think what Putin has demonstrated actually with the Russian foreign policy is that it can turn on a dime. in a matter of, you know, days.
No, and it's done that a few times throughout his presidency. Mark, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I very much agree that there is scope. And to be honest, there are also a lot of people within the system who actually, on very specific issues, can see grounds for cooperating with the West. It doesn't have to be conceptualized in some grand bargain. Just there's lots of in particular sort of technocratic points on which there's cooperation. But the trouble is, I mean, if this bipolar order that Moscow would love to see is to be anything more than just simply negative, in other words, we have a veto, you have to talk to us before anything. If actually Russia wants to be considered sort of an analog to the United States, it's got to be, well, okay, what else can it do? How else can it actually perform some kind of positive actions? And there it's very, very hard to see that it has the money, the reach, the soft power, anything really. Syria was a very, very specific case. It bought equity into Syria with blood and treasure. And because, frankly, the United States had largely vacated the spot. So I think Syria was a I wouldn't say unique, but a sort of an extreme.
There was a perfect storm there.
Yeah, it's just probably exactly. A one-off. Yeah, one-off.
Where else could it be helpful? I suppose maybe one could say in Central Asia, if there was some sudden build-up of jihadism or whatever. But then even then, really all they can do, what they can provide to problems is they can solve any problem that can be bombed out. Beyond that, though, actually Russian options are really very limited. So I mean, I think it is an incredibly threadbare case to make if they're really trying to, you know, if they honestly think that they can do, not just talk about, but do anything like this, then they are, I think, deeply, deeply in denial, even more so than I think.
Than we already suspected.
Yeah. Right now they're practicing, negative great power politics, as Mark said. We have a veto over what you can do internationally, particularly with the force of arms. You come to us and talk to us, and then we agree. But no, in terms of a positive impact, the opportunities are limited.
No, this is, again, and I agree with you, this stands in sharp contrast to the Soviet Union, which in fact was offering a positive agenda, a model, however flawed, that was attractive to some people. What is Russia offering as a positive agenda? You talk about soft power. Even as a model, standing in opposition to the liberal West, with what? With what?
Well, right now, what the positive agenda that the Russians are offering right now with regard to Syria is that we can provide some guarantees against just state collapse and against instability and the emergence of non-state actors where it used to be a state.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of a positive impact that's dependent on what Mark describes as a problem that could be bombed out. But
right.
they view that as a positive contribution, as a positive asset. Again, they even actually claim that this should be another organizing principle of Russia's foreign policy. Providing stability, preventing instability from destroying states, destroying nations.
Well, again, and I keep thinking of the Holy Alliance every time I think of this anti-revolutionary ideology, almost is somewhat reminiscent of the Holy
it's
Alliance.
It's close, but it's not an exact match.
Right?
I would caution against.
As Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself; it rhymes. As I like to often requote.
Whereas the Soviet Union was actually, in its own way, genuinely interested in sort of accreting an empire of Soviet Union clones and proxies and clients. I think today's Russia, it is still completely fixated on Washington, on the United States, and those U.S. overseas dependencies called the European Union. such that, it doesn't. I don't think it's really interesting.
They're going to take away your British citizenship for saying that.
Well, the Brits are leaving the EU, so we can talk like that.
But I mean, I think the thing is, so in that respect, the only real kind of soft power, quote unquote, that the Russians are truly interested in is how they can trade whatever else they've got for respect or at least tolerance from the West. And this is again back to Syria. It's not that they really care about Assad or even necessarily the Syrian regime. It's just that if they let it go, then they lose a card. They lose something that they can trade. Again, I think this is the sort of the issue about what can Russia really offer. And it's a very, very, very threadbare range of options.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, again, reality check, Vladimir, you said it in the very beginning, and I said it on this morning's Daily Vertical. I think it is time for a reality, because there is so much hand-wringing right now in the Western press about how Putin's wrong-footed us again and so on and so forth. All right, well, before we move on, there's something I wanted to touch on, something we've kind of hit on at various points, and that's basically what does Russia want and how would we rank their priorities and how realistic are them achieving each of them. First and foremost, of course, there's dominion over the post-Soviet space, whether we call that an exemption from the rules of the post-Cold War European security architecture or not. That's essentially what it is. Second, they want an end to democratic revolutions, particularly in the post-Soviet space, and presumably beyond it. And an end, so we say no more Georgias, no more Ukraines. They also want an end to so-called, what they call humanitarian interventions, no more Kosovos. And finally, they want some notion of bipolarity, which we all seem to agree is a pipe dream, that they're not going to happen. Is there anything either of you would add to this list? And what do we see of how realistic is achieving any of these?
Well, I'll tell you what, I mean, I wouldn't so much necessarily add as in some ways subtract or dilute. I mean, I think, again, we have to realize how far these are bargaining positions. Yes, the Russians would like to see an end to democratic revolutions. But what really matters are democratic revolutions in their sphere of
influence. In what they see as their sphere.
I think this is it. I mean, in general terms, if they felt, I think, why they were really bothered about Libya and so forth was not so much about Libya, in my opinion, but because the sense of, firstly, that they haven't been properly brought into the conversation, but above all, what can happen in Libya can happen elsewhere and can kind of creep closer and closer.
Again, although they did vote for the Security Council resolution that allowed for the no-fly zone.
But they felt this was a bait and switch. They felt that they'd, voted for something limited and then it was used for regime change. At least that's how Moscow
sees it.
Regards it. So I think when it comes down to it, all of this, I don't really think in the grand scheme of things they care about any of this, really. Except maybe the sort of bipolarity, just simply treat us with respect. Treat us with respect, give us our sphere of influence and guarantee that none of this stuff will happen, that you won't be fomenting domestic revolutions, backing dissidents or anything like that here. And if you want to go and do other things in Latin America or in Africa or even the Middle East, that'll be fine. I think their irreducible minimum is just simply that sort of sense that they have their space.
Mm. Vladimir, would you agree with that, or do you think what you've...
Yes, I would agree with this. I think it should be restricted to basically two regions, the post-Soviet space, and now with the Russian investment in Syria to the Middle East.
Uh-huh.
And I think if we check all those boxes, what is important, I would suggest all of the above, but the utmost importance would be for two points, no NATO and no EU in the former Soviet space. No enlargement whatsoever to other former Soviet republics, that includes Ukraine and Georgia, and not only NATO but also the EU. And of course, no color revolutions in the former Soviet space. Mm. No regime change in the former Soviet space brought about by foreign intervention. And to a certain extent, this also now applies to the Middle East, particularly to countries like Egypt, where Russia is now having an emergence of where Russia has important assets and important cooperation with the new president. And the regime there is, to put it mildly, is problematic. And so Russia would probably be in a position or perhaps willing to intervene in advance to stem any significant revolutionary developments in Egypt.
All right, well, on that note, we'll shift gears in a few moments, so we'll continue our discussion and look at the causes and consequences of Vladimir Putin's tendency to continuously surprise the West. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's still temporarily embedded, is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Путин неоднократно сбивал Обаму с толку за последние пару лет. Начиная с Крыма в 2014 году.
Это стало врасплох многих западных политиков.
Решение президента России стало неожиданностью для всех,
опять
кроме...
Путин превращил свой стиль неожиданных решений.
Президента многим показалось неожиданным.
Well, Putin did it again this week, catching everybody off guard with his unexpected pullback in Syria after nearly 6 months of airstrikes. He did it back in September when he unexpectedly went into Syria in the first place. He did it with the annexation of Crimea. He did it with the intervention in Donbass. The politics of surprise has become a hallmark of Putin's foreign policy. This sets Putin's Russia apart from the Soviet Union, which was a very predictable power. It sets Putin's Russia apart from the early post-Soviet Russia, which was also fairly predictable, albeit chaotic. And it even sets Putin apart from himself during his first two terms when he was largely a cautious international player. What is the point of all this? And is Putin's vaunted unpredictability overrated as an asset? Mark, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we have to divide actually between, as it were, the tactics and the strategy. On one level, the Russians are actually quite good at telling us what they want, if only we're sort of willing to listen to them. But then it's the actual the detail, which is precisely the same, that Putin likes to catch us out. I think there's a variety of reasons. One is good operational security by the Russians. Secondly, it's that much easier because there's such a small circle of people who actually make the decision. I mean, well, one person who makes the decision, but a small circle of people who are probably involved in the real decision-making. Because this is not actually a meaningful democracy, there's none of the usual sort of concerns about wanting to float ideas and see what constituencies are going to think about it and so forth. They really can just simply decide. And finally, I think on a personal level, it seems to me that actually Putin probably quite enjoys surprises and catching people out and using specific dates or days, you know, whether it's the UN General Assembly to announce they're going into Syria or the first day of the Geneva proximity talks to announce this partial withdrawal. You know, it's always that neat targeting. And on general terms, obviously, it gives him vast freedom of maneuver. But I think it is actually problematic. I mean, yes, it means that he has a certain amount of kind of tactical surprise, which obviously helps if you're, for example, trying to steal a small part of another country. But in more general terms, I think it's a problem, firstly, because it alarms people. And the natural desire ought to be within foreign policy and geopolitics for everyone to be happy and comfortable and relaxed. And particularly once you establish a reputation for yourself as not just someone who comes up with surprising ideas, but aggressively surprising ideas, the tendency is it encourages everyone else to worst case scenario and assume the worst. So I think it's actually making, as it were, Russia an increasingly toxic presence on the world stage. People will assume that Russia could tomorrow invade Estonia or strike at Istanbul. Just because, well, that's what Putin's like. And the final very distinct downside, I would say, of this whole kind of mode of policymaking is that precisely, I mean, this is both chicken and egg, as a reflection of that approach, and also this is how it works. It reflects this extraordinary narrow decision-making circle, which means that we have a lot of expertise not being tapped. You know, even if one just looks at this decision, you know, Shoigu and Lavrov both certainly looked as if this had caught them by surprise.
Yes, they did.
And you had right from the beginning a certain sort of confusions. Shoigu saying that sorties would continue to be launched. Ivanov saying they wouldn't. You know, this was not something that had been clearly carefully talked through, carefully rationalized, so that everyone was talking from the same notes. And again, this is actually quite dysfunctional.
And then you had Putin yesterday saying we could be back in a couple hours. You have actually Peace and War in the Rocks today saying Russia's actually not really pulled out much. They've just brought back their levels to pre-surge. They had a surge following the shootdown of the Russians.
That's exactly right. It's not a withdrawal. It's a drawdown. Carefully calculated drawdown. Yeah.
Vladimir, would you agree with that? Is this element of surprise, this politics of surprise, is this what's behind it, and is it a strategic asset or is it a strategic liability?
Well, I would argue, and I've done that already in a piece in Vedomosti, that the new Russian foreign policy starting in 2014. Views the element of surprise as a strategic asset in the pursuit of foreign policy goals. If you take Russian post-Soviet Russian foreign policy, you're correctly arguing that was a very predictable set of ideas and a set of policies. And in fact, it valued predictability as a strategic foreign policy asset as an instrument of building trust. So Russia tried to engage international players with a certain template of predictable answers to certain problems. But I think the Crimea, particularly later on the intervention in eastern Ukraine, they have taught the Russian leadership that they could be fairly unpredictable, and that could be played to Russia's strategic advantage. If nobody can accurately predict what your next move is, then it means that you're putting off your opponents off balance, and you keep them guessing, and you gain a strategic advantage in making the first move to which they would have to react. This is all about what the Russians are saying, setting the agenda, driving the agenda. And Russia now wants to be perceived as a country that is clearly setting agenda and overtaking the United States in driving both regional and global agenda. So, but again, I would agree with Mark that the reason it has become possible, so it's now being viewed as an asset, as a very valuable tool of foreign policy. But the reason it has come about to be is, as Mark correctly says, is because the foreign policy decision making in Russia, unlike in Western states, is anchored in a much smaller circle of people, with operational security being the top priority. It allows them extremely significant degree of flexibility in foreign policy. In making foreign policy decisions, if you take, for example, the decision by the Federation Council granting Putin the right to use Russia's military force abroad, which was done on September 29th, the day before the Syria bombings started, the decision doesn't even mention the region where the Russian military force could be used, nor does it identify the time frame within which the use of force could be implemented. It basically says that Putin can decide to strike anywhere at any time. And on the one hand, that gives Russia some advantage because no one knows what to expect. But on the other, as Mark is saying, it destroys trust and it reduces credibility of Russian foreign policy, because now people are saying you have to watch what Russia is doing. You don't really should be paying attention to what Russia is saying.
Yeah, no, that's
and
true.
That I think is not a very good foreign policy situation to find itself in. You have to be a certain degree of predictable power like China.
And you, I think you correctly say, well, one of the drivers of this is the narrow decision-making circle, which not only is it more narrow than in Western countries, it's more narrow than the Soviet Union.
Absolutely.
Mark, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think I'd want to just add to that. I very much agree, though. I think in a way, I don't think the narrow circle is driven by operational security. I think it's almost a sort of a a byproduct. I think it's driven by much wider political things. But the interesting thing is precisely this notion of how the Russians look at foreign policy success. And I think exactly the Russians have got this extraordinary zero-sum approach at the moment, a notion that somehow catching people off guard, having people dismayed and surprised, is in itself
right.
positive.
Yes, yes. It's becoming in itself a goal.
Yeah, their notion of kind of strategic effect, of effects-based policy, which is the sort of, you know, the mantra everyone wants, is not, does it actually get us to some wider geopolitical point, but we had a great effect because, by God, look how wrong-footed they were. By God, look how many op-eds there were in the newspapers.
Right.
Why do we keep getting caught out or whatever? Without actually stopping and thinking, well, yeah, but did it actually do us any good?
Yeah, no, I think you make a good point there, Mark. And I don't know if you noticed on Russian television, they were playing up all of the headlines in Western newspapers saying how Russia catches the West off guard again. And they've one headline after another. And this in and of itself was a point of pride. There's something else also that I think that's driving this. And it's something we kind of alluded to in the first half is that, I mean, the Soviet Union was predictable largely because the Soviet Union was a status quo power. It wanted to preserve the status quo. It was not a revolutionary power. Russia is, in Kissingerian terms, a revolutionary power. It's seeking to overthrow the existing international order. And in such an environment, this unpredictability probably is seen as an asset, no?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure in the sort of this kind of almost philosophical perspective, because when it comes down to it, as I said, it's not actually as if the Russians are not fairly clear about their wider goals and ambitions. They will surprise us in exactly how they assert and seek to get there. You know, but we knew that they, for example, wanted the Assad regime retained, or at least they need to be part of that conversation well before there was a single Russian bomber at Latakia. You know, we knew that they were opposed to certain. I mean, you know, this is it actually. We do know what the Kremlin wants of the world. It's actually how it goes about it. And therefore, in this respect, yes, it is indeed revolutionary, or I prefer the term insurgent, trying to reshape it. But again, it's like most insurgents. It's actually got its revolutionary credo. But again, as an insurgent, it has the opportunity, the advantage of striking first. It is undoubtedly the weakest power, like any insurgent. But one of its strengths is that it decides the battlefields.
Right. Vladimir, would you agree? So this is an asymmetric tactic of an insurgent?
Yes, I think so. It compensates for the deficiencies in other aspects of power. Mm-hmm. The ability to make quick decisions and quickly implement them is certainly an asset, and it's being viewed as an asset.
Okay, we're pushing up towards the end here. Just before we wrap it up, do we expect any more surprises from Mr. Putin in the near future? And anybody want to venture to guess where they may come?
Well, I think it will largely depend on how the relationship with the West plays out, particularly in Europe. If, you know, the need to surprise and upend specific situations stems from Russia's desire to change things in Europe. And if Russia and the West come to a certain, accommodation that the Russians would agree to uphold in the longer term, then I think the need for tactical surprise would diminish. Mm.
Mark, last word to you.
I mean, I'm wondering if, in some ways, that the surprise might actually turn out to be in sort of which Putin we get. I'm thinking of Fiona Hill and Cliff Gaddy's Mr. Putin, operative in the Kremlin, that sort of talks about this kind of variety of Putins. Now, of late, this presidential term, we've seen the aggressive, for want of a better word, imperialist Putin. But it's quite interesting at the moment that the Russians are now very much sort of pushing. There's a possible federal solution in Syria and so forth. And not for peacemaking reasons, but I wonder if, as it were, Putin's next surprise will be something that actually looks conciliatory, not necessarily with the West, but even over Syria, in order to basically keep us off balance. Because I don't see any I don't think we're going to see some massive surge into Ukraine, for example. I don't see any other sort of interventions that, frankly, Russia could do or would want to do. And therefore, I think, again, if he wants to keep the strategic surprise going, then actually he needs to change his game for a bit to catch us off guard, maybe for when he then wants to do something more aggressive again.
Mm. Okay, on that note, we will wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow has been Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from Moscow, also via Skype, has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group, and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Thank you, gentlemen, for an interesting discussion.
Thanks, Brian. Pleasure to be with you.
Pleasure to have you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.